today is probably the most exciting episode in my opinion, because today we're going to really be able to see the development of classical music to what it is right now. We can see parts of classical music already starting to come together. And while Indian classical music is a much more detailed history than the level we're looking at, it's very exciting to see some things come together. So last week, we covered a lot of our journey. We talked about the Dattelam that sort of laid the foundation for the way that musical concepts would later be approached, and also how it made that transition to ICM a whole lot smoother. We also looked at Deshi music, music of the people, and then we were introduced to the Sufi music that is now such an integral part of Indian singing. We looked at Amir Khusro, his poems, and the lasting legacy that he left behind. We also looked at Raja Man Singh, Tan Sen, and then we reached Akbar. So now we'll learn what happened after Akbar. Hey there, and welcome back to another episode of Jhalak, a glimpse into Indian classical music. In the description box of this episode, if you're interested in that and if you want to check it out, it's right there for you. And while there were interested emperors such as Akbar or Jahangir, there were also emperors like, well, Aurangzeb, who was an ambitious emperor who expanded the Mughal Empire by a lot. While he was quite a controversial figure in Indian history, music was still being practiced during his time, which is contrary to the popular belief that Aurangzeb banned music. According to historian Catherine Butler Schofield, music wasn't banned in Aurangzeb's court, with his own coronation anniversaries being marked by both musicians and dancers. According to other texts at the time, a lot of Drupads were composed at the time. So the time frame of these, the composition of these Drupads matches with the reign of Aurangzeb. He also enabled the publication of Rag Darpan, a musical treatise that was a translation of Raja Man Singh's Mankuthal, which, if you remember, we looked at last episode. And if this is not enough, his dearest son, Azam Shah, during the lifetime of his father, went on to become an accomplished musician. Let's take a step back and look at the entire Mughal era. So all in all, the Mughal era has really affected Indian classical music in such an integral way that it really can't be reversed. It's very deeply rooted in the art. And with that, we move on to the relatively modern period, which is 1700 AD onwards. Look at that, only a few more centuries to go. Okay, so in the modern period, we start to see an increasing number of musical texts in different languages, different regional languages such as Persian, Urdu, Hindi, rather than Sanskrit, which is a more broad, a more national, and sort of involves the entire country. All these texts continue to show us how music has evolved through time. Now, what we see that's different is that from the beginning of the 19th century, many Indian scholars started writing texts and material on Hindustani music in English as well as other languages. Now, you might be thinking, why would that be the case? Because English was never a spoken language in India, I have never mentioned it before, so why all of a sudden? So all these Mughal emperors had their own way of doing things. Akbar's court was open to many people. Emperors like him, such as Jahangir, were also genuinely interested in music and therefore they generously supported the art. But other than texts written in English, what else had changed? Well, many other musical forms were created, the most notable ones being Khayal and Tumri, which I will have linked in the description box of this episode. New genres were also invented, and excuse me if I say this wrong. Another person now that changed ICM was a person called Raja Surendra Mohan Tagore. That's a pretty long name. Well, I thought this too, until I researched that it was in the 19th century when India was starting to come under the influence of Britain, especially with the British East India Company, and that would last for the next two centuries or so. And I think that it was Raja Surendra that, you know, for the first time looked outside India, and saw outside of India, saw what Indian music and culture and South Asian music and culture had to offer to the rest of the world. This is a very powerful notion, and we will see that it only continues to grow as we move on in time. But if the name Tagore sounds familiar to you, it is because Raja Surendra came from the family that the very famous polymath Rabindranath Tagore would later come from. I guess when they say that it runs in the family, they're not wrong. Anyway, Surendra had a dream, a very grand dream. He dreamed to take ICM international. In fact, this was his mission in life, to take Hindustani music international, take it to that international stage, and allow people outside of India to appreciate its appeal to human emotions and all of that. He studied at the Hindu College in Calcutta and took an interest in both Indian and Western music. He was the first person to set up an Indian orchestra in Calcutta. He donated many Indian instruments to museums across the world. I'm talking about Pandit Vishnu Paluskar and Pandit Vishnu Bhatkhande. They both did so many things. Like, one of the things they did that was pretty major was introducing the first music college in India. I have the same first name. And these two people changed music as we know it. And they did that all through their passion and their hard work. They both provided a new perspective on Indian classical music. And in doing that, they uplifted the status of musicians in Indian society. Now, let's focus on Bhatkhande. What Bhatkhande did is pretty awesome. He did a lot of things. A lot. But in short, Bhatkhande pioneered the introduction of an organized musical system reflecting current performance practices. He wanted to put it all together, I guess you could say. And while there were a lot of texts that tried to unify music, there were still some differences and it just wasn't working. It just wasn't as cohesive as what it could be. Now Bhatkhande changed that. He changed the classifications of ragas, for example. Before, ragas were classified in two different major types, ragas and raginis, raginis were essentially the female version of those ragas. Bhatkhande sat down and he rethought this. He classified it into a tat system, which it is still used to classify ragas today. He took the huge, and I mean huge, task of restating the musicological framework underlying contemporary musical performance. Now, how did he do this? Well, this is where it gets super cool. So what he did is he did music fieldwork in order to accurately restate this framework. So if I was to put this simply, he traveled all across India. He physically went to every single place where there was a different kind of music that was being practiced. He visited different schools from different gharanas, which is something that I will touch on a bit later. So he visited these different schools, and what he did is take very meticulous notes. He noted down all the different styles, their differences to different regions, similarities, all of that. And it's crazy to think the level that he must have taken these notes at, because at the time, remember, this is like a century ago, so he couldn't really record anything at the time. There wasn't that technology, so he had to take notes. And after compiling all these notes, he was able to collect some data. So the data that he collected was then documented and analyzed. And over time, he started to see, and he started joining things together. And over time, he developed this framework. That is a ton of hard work, and it sure has paid off, because even today, many musicians and students use Bhatkhande's literature and findings to study Hindustani classical music systematically. All in all, Bhatkhande classifies more than 1,800, that is 1,800 compositions from the gharanas that were accessible to him, and he divided them into 10 tats. That is pretty genius, if you ask me. So earlier, I said I touch on gharanas because that is a pretty big part of ICM. The gharana concept gained traction around the 19th century when the royals' support for performers weakened. Performers had to move to urban areas, to cities, and in order to retain their identities, they took the name of the regions that they originally came from. That's why today, a lot of the names for gharanas are the names of places. The concept of a gharana has been around for so long that it can now be taken more broadly to indicate a complete, comprehensive musical idea. This ideology changes from one gharana to another, and it affects how thinking, teaching, and performing is done in each gharana. So there are small, tiny... Some well-known gharanas are the Agra gharana, Gwalior gharana, Patiala gharana. And if you've ever heard of Kaushiki Chakravarti, she is absolutely sensational. She is from the Patiala gharana, and so is her dad, Ajay Chakravarti. And there's the Indore gharana, Kirana gharana, Jaipur gharana, Mewat gharana, and the list just goes on and on and on. There are many more gharanas. Nuances between different types of gharanas. Now, what I mean is that if you listen to a piece of music from, let's say, the Jaipur gharana, you might be able to notice some characteristics specific to that gharana itself. And you'll find some differences if you compare it to another type of gharana. It was a very big thing when it was first developed, but now a lot of people have differing opinions on it. Some people still believe it to be an extremely important part of music, but others think that it is more important when it was developed, and now music should be appreciated as a whole. And unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I hope that you enjoyed today's episode and that you were able to see the last bit of development to today's ICM. Now, before we call it a day, I unfortunately have a sad announcement to make. Sadly, next week will be my last episode for this season, but we will be finishing off on a very good note with an interview with two pretty amazing people, so get excited for that. Anyways, as always, if you enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to support it on any of the podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode of